Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to the show. Welcome back. We're here. It's Action Movie Anatomy on a brand new day. That's right. It's Thursday. It's 2 p.m. and we're going to break down one of the greatest films of our lifetime. This is the iconic post-apocalyptic film, Children of Men. We're so excited. We'll see you guys in just one quick second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! Aha!
99 plus 4 pennies.
95.
Damn it.
Guess who's back? What's up, everybody? Welcome back. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the studio. It rhymed. It's Action Movie Anatomy.
I feel like we haven't been here in forever.
It does feel that way. Things have been tumultuous. Things have been chaotic. Things have been exciting. Things have been victorious.
Victorious. Victory!
Yes. It's an exciting Thursday, guys. There's a lot to talk about today on the show, so just to get the quick intros out of the way, this is Action Movie Anatomy. It's a show where we talk about action movies here on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking movies, all things movie-related and pop culture by the bucketful. I'm merely your host, Ben Bateman, joined by my co-host, co-creator, co-producer, and the champion! Not all the way yet, but, you know, two-time winner.
Two-time double knockout of two-time champions. It's Andrew Guy. I'm very happy to be here. I'm excited to be back, and I cannot wait to destroy and embarrass that geriatric F, John Roca.
It's not even says. Oh, you said his name. Okay.
I'm going to, because he has, he's been on the show before, so you guys all know who he is.
Yeah, he's been on two different times.
Yeah, so we are no longer friends. We are foe now. But yeah, we're back. We moved to Thursday. Things have been crazy, but it's been wonderful.
Yeah, a little State of the Union for you guys here. The first one is that we had to change to Thursdays based on scheduling. I had missed probably three in the last 11 weeks based on Wednesdays are a tough day for me. You booked a new gig that is going to have you permanently out of here Wednesdays.
Yes.
So for at least the next several months, which we don't know how much longer it'll be, we are going to just be on Thursdays at 2 p.m. That's the new, it works, we can make it happen, 2 p.m., it's a little easier. I'm sure there'll still be missed days here and there, but we're going to do our best to be here as consistently as possible, and as it stands now, it works.
Yeah, and for all the people out there that have been watching us at a certain time for, I mean, it feels like it's been over a year now, that we've been on Wednesdays.
I think we've been on Wednesdays at 2 for like 2 years.
Like 2 years, yeah. It's been a very long time. Thank you for making the adjustment. We apologize for switching it up. We hope that you guys find the new day live. We always love having you in chat. But again, we understand schedules change.
Of course. And people, hopefully you guys will catch up and you'll be here as we go forward. So a couple other things going on. A big shout out to brand new members of the Team Action Patreon. We got William Bedford, who's not just a new member, but he's a new general. He's actually upgraded. He is now a general of the Action Army, so that's a big salute to you, sir.
Bah.
And we've also got Anika R. Big salute to you as well.
Bah. Yeah, William Belford is an awesome dude. He's been like very interactive on Twitter with us, and he's been a fan of the show, MTS, all that good stuff.
Just
so
gave up smoking. Congratulations.
Oh, man. Yeah, congratulations. That's actually, hell yeah.
Yeah.
William gave up smoking. He's been doing great, and he used his extra money to become a general in the Army.
In the Army.
Which is, like, very inspiring.
Yeah,
so
it's a big deal.
Yeah, and then the other thing that we wanted to talk about really quickly, guys, before we hop into the show, we actually have a little bit of extra time at the end of the show today, so we're going to burn a little at the beginning. It's been a really exciting couple months for us, but more importantly, our Action Army and Action Movie Anatomy page and this show, we're all hitting, like, we're about to hit 200 episodes. We hit a year anniversary in the groups. This has brought so much joy to our lives, so much work to our lives. It's actually kept our friendship very, very strong over the last couple of years as we've gotten busier. So from Ben and I know that we are just so grateful and thankful for every single one of you. Whether you're a patron or not, whether you've watched every episode or you've only seen two, we cannot thank you enough for all your support.
Yeah, it's been a pretty amazing few years, and especially since the Action Army got really rolling. Just what a fun time. New friends, new fans, new supporters, new inside jokes. So just a big thank you, guys. One more time. We salute you. Yeah. So the last thing to shout out here before we get into the actual show, because we've got a great show coming up for you today, is RIP Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Just happened a few hours ago.
Yeah, and I had no idea. I walked into the studio, and you're like, "Did you hear?" And I was like, "What?" And you're like, "Burt died a couple hours ago." And I was truly saddened. I don't know Burt well, like, as an actor. I haven't watched a lot of his stuff, but we do have one movie in common that we love,
which is Boogie Nights. You know, you guys, a lot of you guys know, as you've watched us over the years, there's a phrase we use a lot when we talk about something. It's a real movie, Jack.
It's a real movie, Jack.
And that's Jack Horner we're referring to there, played by Burt Reynolds, famously in Boogie Nights, his only Oscar nomination for the film Boogie Nights. And he's unbelievable in that role. And I think, and I tweeted about this, but I believe that the greatest actors are the ones where their talent and their significance keeps them relevant for multiple generations, right? Even if you...
Yeah, when you transcend generations, when you evolve with movie making,
you become an integral character in another film, in another generation, and younger people know who you are for one reason or another, and that's a big deal. So, you know, for me, Burt Reynolds is not somebody that I was old enough to have grown up watching Deliverance or Smokey and the Bandit or The Longest Yard or any of these films, you know, Cannonball Run. I mean, I've seen a lot of these movies, but... I was born in 88. None of those films came out after 88.
Right, and it's not like movies that you were just like dying. He wasn't one of your favorite actors like the same way that Paul Newman was, where you would go back and watch all of his films.
He was a movie star more than he was an actor for the most part. I mean, he was really somebody who was great in his roles, but he didn't stretch. He was a sex symbol in his time. Like, he was truly like one of those guys. And so, but just seeing that news today, I mean, Boogie Nights is... It's arguably my favorite film of all time. I mean, it's right up there, and he's great in it. And so, you know, just a big cheers.
Yeah, you brought a lot of joy to our lives, man. So I hope you're doing well up there.
Rest easy, legend.
Yeah. Guys, this is Action Movie Anatomy. This is a show where we talk about action movies, and we have four basic rules that every single episode must follow. What are those rules, Bateman?
Rule number one, the hero always plays by their own rules.
Nope.
He doesn't.
Not at all.
He just like kind of follows the system.
He's just so not in his element.
Meanders through drunk, just like only until like, yeah, not at all. The hero and the villain are always the smartest people, beings, things, dinosaurs that have you in the room. Well, he's sort of the smartest because he manages to like get away and outsmart the bad guys, kind of. And I guess the other smartest guy in the room is Infertility.
Yeah, Infertility or Sid. Sid's definitely not the other smartest guy in the room or the villain. Yeah, Infertility. And I think... It's one of those things where as we get older and the world evolves and things change, these dystopian movies, and you realize that infertility is the villain, and it's like horrifying, and it's like the fact that I actually think it's really beautifully written.
Yeah,
I think it's something
gorgeous.
That's very feasible, and I love the panic that everyone in the movie goes through. They have nothing to live for, you know?
I think, you know, if we're being totally accurate, and sometimes we do this, I think you would say that a combination of... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Julianne Moore and Clive Owen, the combination of those two together,
mm-hmm.
I think that's the hero, because she trusts him as the only person she can trust. And so her intelligence and his ability and their sort of like commitment to one another that you feel throughout the film, that is sort of the smartest guy in the room.
Yes, and then I was going to say on the other edge side of that, she would tell Ejiofor, and Infertility is like the villain. Because he's actually, he lasts to the very end. He's like, he's definitely not that smart because he's going against a tank in a building, but
So, that's rule number two. The rule number three, the movie is driven by police, military, political, or mercenary figure. He's not. He's none of those things. Rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. There's a bunch of explosions in this movie. They're sweet.
We got one and a half.
Yeah.
Or four.
You know, as the show has evolved, we just don't care anymore.
Honestly, we really don't, because we just want to talk about movies that we think are fantastic and that we love. And I'm pretty sure the trailer for this movie is pretty sweet.
Yeah, I don't know. Coming up, guys, just before we watch the trailer here on the show today, we are going to be answering some of your Action Movie Anatomy questions submitted on the Twitter and on the Facebook. We are going to be doing Overly Sieged, Underly Sieged, Properly Sieged on Clive Owen. We are going to be ranking the three amigos of Mexican cinema. That is Guillermo del Toro, Alfonso Cuarón, and Alejandro González Iñárritu. They are all friends who have worked for years together on each other's films, all acclaimed, all Oscar winners. So let's talk about their films.
Yeah, I'm excited for that.
I certainly can't remember when anyone else did either.
Marissa Serafini in the booth. Feels great to have you back, Marissa.
Yeah.
Since women stopped being able to have babies, what's left to hope for?
The world was stunned today by the death of Diego Ricardo, the youngest person on the planet. The youngest person on Earth was 18 years, 4 months, 20 days, 16 hours, and 8 minutes old.
I watched a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff on this about how they filmed it all the different single cam stuff, all the handheld stuff, the crazy apparatus that they filmed. You've seen that before.
I think I've seen it years and years ago. I don't remember it.
They built this insane apparatus to film the single take in a car. It like looks like a boat. There's like a boat on top of a car on top of a platform with like this crazy arm, and the camera can move all around inside the car. It's crazy.
I'm sorry about the theatrics.
Cuarón was not he was famous, but he wasn't like the Alfonso Cuarón that he is now.
Now he's like kind of a honestly, he's kind of been forgotten of the three. He hasn't made something like super impactful in the last couple of years.
He's made two movies in the last 12 years.
Yeah, Gravity and this. I mean, not Gravity.
Yeah, Gravity.
Yeah, Gravity. Yeah,
he won Best Director for Gravity. Yeah, yeah.
I trust you.
Show him.
Right.
Now you know it's the part where the woman holding the arm, I seriously went, holy shit. Yeah, we all did.
Yeah.
Welcome to the movie.
The Human Project have sent a boat.
The Human Project?
Oh, there's the greatest minds in the world working for a new society.
Sigur Rós.
Yep. I love Sigur Rós.
Me too. The whole world another thing that makes me feel old.
Yeah, right. All right.
We will find a way to get you to the Human Project, I promise you.
I'm getting chills.
Yeah.
We're almost there, Keith. We're almost there.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
And it's so beautiful.
Yeah,
like, it's so beautifully shot.
So this will get into our thesis statements here. And it, you know, there's obvious ones. There are difficult ones. Yeah. I thought a lot about mine, and I struggled to come up with a thesis statement that I really loved. I feel strongly about mine, but it's not as refined as some of the others in the past. So I'm going to let you jump in first.
Yeah,
here.
Sure. I'll hop in first here. I do quickly want to remind everybody, just in case you're watching or listening for the very first time, what our thesis statement segment of the show is.
What are you doing right now?
I'm just going to pass to you and then interrupt you. Thesis statement is your biggest, boldest thought on the film. It is the thing that if this film came up at a party, you would say, here's the thing about Children of Men. And you would lay this on them, and then this would be sort of the thing you'd hope to blow their mind with. This is your I'm really smart about movies moment. It's the biggest, boldest thought you have. Should never be my favorite this. It's almost rooted in hyperbole.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if mine's like going to make me sound like super smart when I say it, because it's like there's a lot of really broad thesis that you and I discuss. Like, is this Clive Owen's best movie? Is this the best dystopian film? Is this Cuarón's best? Like all these best of it's just so general.
And mine still is actually kind of general, but it's a little more pointed to something that I discuss a lot on this show, and that's the IMDb top 250.
Yeah.
And now while you and I don't exactly see eye to eye on the top 250, we do agree that most of the movies in it, when we talk about them and have seen them, we're like, okay, it makes sense. Like, this movie did this for filmmaking, or this movie impacted me in this way. For me, I am not only shocked, but I'm appalled that this film is not in the 250, the top 250. Even if it was number 250, look, like, it is beautifully shot.
It's a better movie than Wonder Woman.
It is a better movie than Wonder Woman. It really is. It's a better movie than Rush.
Yeah.
And I like Rush.
Yeah.
And I think it deserves to be in the top 250. But this movie, it's so beautifully shot. The set design is absolutely incredible. Like, you look at the end of the film when they're coming around the corner in a tracking shot with hundreds of extras while guns are going off, while there's blood on the camera, there's tanks and there's buildings falling, and there's so much coordination and choreography. It's masterful from a technical standpoint. And then you take it to the writing. Brilliant, simple story, and the acting is beyond perfect. Michael Caine, one of his best roles ever.
He's great.
I just can't believe it.
It's very surprising.
Can't.
Yeah, I agree. It might be the most glaring omission. Always hard to say there because there are only 250 spots on that list, and there's so many great movies in the world, but I hear you on that one. I'm going to jump in next with mine. I'm going to say no film has ever contrasted dirt in its subject matter and beauty in its capture of that subject matter better than this film.
I get it's a little convoluted, but I know what you're saying.
It's basically the contrast between the dirty backdrop, the dirty subject matter, the hopelessness, and how beautifully this film is shot.
Right.
I've never seen anything in my life that does it as beautifully as this. It's one of the most beautifully shot films I've ever seen, and it is so dirty, it is so grimy, it's so violent.
You want to cry all the time for two reasons. It's so beautiful, and it's so heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the actual visuals of it is so beautiful that, like, it's like when you look at a painting, or you like step out in a mountain, you look out, you're like, I just want to cry. It's like that, but then also, it's so bleak.
Yeah. it's crazy. And the themes that run throughout this film, you know, hope, hopelessness, there's just a lot to unpack here. So I didn't quite know how to put it into words, but that was the biggest takeaway that I sort of found myself thinking about when I was rewatching scenes of this film this morning, and we watched it last night, but
yeah.
Rewatching scenes on my phone just to sort of like, I wanted to see that moment again. And like what I was struck with was like, I remember watching this film in theaters in 2006. I remember being in theaters with my girlfriend at the time, Hannah. And I remember we watched this movie and that scene with the baby when they start coming down the stairs and everything stops.
Ugh.
I remember like being moved to tears in the theater. Like I just remember this. Like it was just very impactful. Like I haven't seen a lot of movies that I can like remember feeling that way in a certain scene as clearly as this movie.
Well, it's so beautifully shot. The juxtaposition of going into the building and leaving the building. Think about them going in. You know,
yeah.
Tanks are shooting at it. Clive's foot is cut open, bloody. Key's not there.
Yeah.
It's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
And then, flash forward to 5 minutes later, the whole world has stopped.
Yeah.
Completely.
For about a minute.
For about 1 minute. And then, everyone's reminded of like, oh yeah, this is what it's like when there's hope.
Right.
This is what it's like. And then they go back to where they are, which is hopeless. And
yep.
Everything just goes crazy again. Then the guns go off. I love Cuarón's way of just putting the viewer there. The camera is the viewer.
Yeah.
We are right there watching everything.
Yeah.
We're omnipresent.
Yep.
Yeah. The juxtaposition of that scene is absolutely beautiful. And it ties in perfectly with your thesis.
Yeah.
Like you want to cry, but you just can't stop looking.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I do remember walking out of this film and feeling like this is perhaps one of the best movies I'd ever seen when I walked out of the theater. When I made my list of 50 favorite films last year, I think this was in the honorable mentions. I don't think it made my top 50, but then watching it again. I did notice, though, last night saying to you, there is a style of film that I don't find as compelling over time to watch, and that's like as beautiful as this movie is and as incredible as I think it is, like, I find that once I've seen a film like 3 or 4 times, there has to be some sort of campy, quotable, memorable quality
mm-hmm.
that makes me want to keep watching it. Because otherwise, it's like, I don't know. It's like it lacks some like...
It's like you need a little bit of fun.
Stupid comedies get better on repeat viewings.
Yes.
Stupid action movies get better on repeat viewings. Cheesy movies that make you feel something,
right.
Like Warrior, get better on repeat viewings. They have fist pump moments. Like, they have tangible, like... Yes.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
movie like is beautiful, but that doesn't really have that kind of thing in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and like we talked about the other movies that are kind of that feel that way, like Requiem and The yeah. Road, and there's a lot of really great movies that and that's like, you know, that's what's great about you and I is it separates us as people because yeah. I like those movies.
You I like to rewatch them.
I like to rewatch the bleak, the sad. Like last night when I was watching Children of Men, it was maybe one of the most enjoyable instances I've had watching a movie in a long time.
Yeah.
We've talked about it a lot, that we don't watch movies we've seen before.
Anymore, really?
As much anymore because yeah. of Schmodown. And so, like, I haven't seen Children of Men in years. And, like, watching it last night was a true treat for me.
Yeah. Definitely. So that's going to wrap up Fist Pump Moment, guys, or a thesis statement, I should say. Put it in the chat. Leave it in the comments. Tweet at us. If you want to find me on Twitter, you can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
You guys can find me at Andrew Guy.
Yeah. And we have the podcast, which is at Team Action Show.
Yes.
So check that stuff out. Actually, speaking of Team Action Show, this is pretty fun. We have some pretty good stuff coming up here. We'll talk about Patreon in a little bit. But one of the things, if you are a Patreon in the Team Action Show Patreon, is at the highest levels... We do this thing now where we do speeches celebrities in the voice of your celebrity doing the speech of your choice. So the ones that we have coming out.
They're so good.
Andrew does the Independence Day speech, the Bill Pullman Independence Day speech in the voice of Albert Finney.
Yes.
And it's really good. It's very funny. It's on my computer right now. I'm editing it. It's going to go up soon. You're going to find that. We're going to make them public, actually. So it's not those won't be behind a paywall. I will probably honestly play them on the show so you'll hear them. But
yeah, we might do it during like the old Cage versus Cruz segment. And then Ben, on the other hand, for Brienne Chandler, does Quaylen from Cliffhanger, John Lithgow,
Tucker. Don't you forget it, Tucker.
Doing the speech from Magnolia, the respect the cock speech from Magnolia from Tom Cruise. It's brilliant. They're both brilliant. We got together last night. We filmed a bunch of segments for the Patreon, patreon.com/teamaction. And we had some scotch. And then we were like, before we watch Children of Men, we were like a little drunk. And we were like, should we just do this?
Knock
this
out.
It was amazing.
They're funny.
Yeah.
So those will go up very soon, guys. So go find, you know, subscribe to that. I think probably also if you're wondering how to find the YouTube, because we just have started, we haven't like really posted anything, you can just go to patreon.com/teamaction, and we will be publicly posting like the link onto that page, so you'll be able to find kind of what we're doing there. So anyway,
yeah.
All right, guys, let's continue through the show. Next up on the show, we've got Fist Pump Moment. This is that moment in the movie, something happens, you look around, you're like, oh my God, are you seeing this right now? This is so good! Yes, I get to watch the rest of this movie! You get so excited, you call your buddy, you need to show someone.
This movie is very interesting in fist pumps.
As I said, right, it doesn't exactly have moments that make me feel like, yes! It has moments that make me feel like, holy shit.
Yeah, because all the greatest moments, it's like, oh, a baby's being born. Can they hear it? Oh, he sees the baby. Are they going to kill him?
Yeah, right.
Oh, Clive, they get away. Clive dies, like, or does he? And you're like, there's no real, like, yes!
Yeah, it's not confirmed at the end, right?
It's not confirmed, which yeah. I like.
Yeah,
they were, actually, guys, if you're in the chat right now, and since it's not confirmed, and Marissa hasn't seen this movie, which is great, because now we're not spoiling it, yes, I am Sean Harris Lit. Guys, what do you think? Is he alive? Is he dead? We got a fist pump explosion of emotion. I'll call my baby Dylan.
Yeah, it's a really good moment.
Because that's the name of his son, which is heartbreaking. The closest thing to a fist pump is when the soldiers yell...
Ceasefire.
Yep, yeah. That is absolutely fantastic. That's Arena and Richard there. Our fist pump moments are more like, mine's like a holy shit filmmaking moment.
I do want to check something. Hey, Marissa, up in the booth, how you doing?
What's up, gentlemen?
Hey, you know, I'm feeling a little warm. Is there any chance we could check and see if, oh yeah, no,
No,
Andrew,
I feel warm
guy's
as well.
Temperature is...
Sure. I definitely feel warm as well.
Thank you, I appreciate that, Marissa. You haven't seen this movie, really?
I have not, no.
Do you remember it coming out?
I am a fan of Clive Owen. I remember it coming out, I just never got to it.
Interesting, yeah, this is one you should definitely watch. It's not good in that bad action movie way that so many of the films we do. It's like actually really, really, really good.
But
yeah.
I'm really excited, and I've already made an agreement with Andrew to borrow it from
I'm going
to
bring her the DVD.
Sweet.
Yes.
Awesome. Excellent.
So I want you to go first on this one because I don't want to take it. And if you don't mention it, I have to mention it and then I'm going to tell you mine.
I know what I believe yours is.
I know what you think it is.
Okay. So for me, it's so hard for it not to be the big long tracking shot in the car, only because from a filmmaking perspective, it's like you just don't really see things that are that impressive very often. That was like Mad Max Fury Road level of holy shit. It was like, it was like one of those things where you're just like, this is like actually real. You're just doing this
you
in
just
one take,
did this.
And like the ping pong ball, all of it's like what?
Yeah, the ping pong ball is like starts it off, and then you see the car roll in on fire, and you're like, what's going on?
It's just amazing. But my fist pump moment in this film is actually at the end. It's the moment we talked about. The baby's crying, ceasefire, and you have this moment of like, wow, maybe the world can stop it from killing itself. And then an explosion goes off, and they go right back to it.
Yeah.
And that's the moment for me where you're just like,
have we learned nothing?
It's like humanity cannot save itself. That's the moment where you're like, it doesn't. Humanity is destined to destroy itself.
This is the first time in almost two decades a child has been seen, and they risk killing it right after seeing it.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me.
It's insane. And yeah, I think for me, that's such a powerful moment. So I think that's probably my fist pump. You know, there are obvious other ones, like them hitting the asshole with the dreadlocks with the car door. There are other moments.
That's excellent. The bike actually flipping is like an insane fist pump moment. So I like that. And I love that you use that because that was like partially mine.
Yeah.
But so mine's the end. It's so from a filmmaking standpoint, it's the beginning of the tracking shot where Clive gets through the door. He kills Sid with the car battery. I love the quick kill of Sid. It's just like so brutal. And just real. Just done. One hit, done.
You think Sid's definitely dead?
I think so. I think you can hear his like neck break or just like
it's imagine a getting heavy hit. Piece of metal.
Yeah, that's gnarly. But my fist pump is Clive cuts his foot. He cuts his foot badly in real life. He goes, oh, fuck. And you see the blood come down. That's not fake blood. That's real blood. And then he does the whole shot.
Yeah.
The whole scene while he's bleeding. And it's just so amazing from a fan of film to see that. I mean, it's like the Aragorn moment when he kicks the helmet and breaks his toe, except for then he screams and the thing cuts. And people are like, man, that was a real scream.
Yeah.
This is a real, like, two-minute tracking shot with a guy with a cut foot on, like, rocks in a war zone. I'm like so heated right now.
In the behind the scenes stuff, when Clive's talking about making this movie, one of the things that he says is these long shots that Cuarón wanted to make. And it's interesting, too, that in RE2, you know, they do similar things. They have interest in sort of a similar style of filmmaking in that sense. But these long shots that, that Cuarón was experimenting with, Owen is saying there's sort of a collaborative team feeling when you shoot a film like this, because everybody has to rehearse so much and it's all choreographed so perfectly that you really do feel like it's this team effort to pull it off.
The extras matter just as much as you.
Yeah. And so like when he cuts his foot, it's like his commitment to keep going is such a, that just it, like it's a moment of solidarity where everybody on the team is like, we're just going to do this. And he cut his foot, but like, he's going to keep doing it. I'm going
to
keep doing it.
If he doesn't,
yeah,
they have to reset. Like, I bet you at least $10,000 worth of stuff. Probably $50 to $100.
And in a shot that big, you're talking about an entire day.
Yeah.
You probably have one shot at it at the beginning of the day to get it all set. You probably don't get to reset and shoot that a second time. I'll bet you. I'll bet you it takes a full day.
That's just insane. So those are our fist pumps, guys. Let us know what your fist pumps are. A lot of the things in the chat are more like holy shit moments, which I completely understand.
Holding the arm, maybe.
Yeah, the holding arm is in there. We've got the baby drying scene. It was really beautiful, like finally seeing it. Ceasefire, obviously. I'll call my baby Dylan's a fist pump. Yeah, so those are all excellent fist pumps, guys. We're going to move... Should we move on?
Yeah, I think. So quickly before we get into production development, which we're going to get to in just 1 second, we mentioned patreon.com/teamaction. So what that is, if anybody was wondering, is that Andrew and I every single week now, not just one, we do two videos. We do two extra videos in front of this giant mural of Nick Cage that I have on the wall of my apartment.
And it's also hanging outside of a bar somewhere in the UK.
And we do top five lists. If you guys pay $5 or more, you get to submit your lists of top five. And then Andrew and I will go in and we'll rank them and we'll talk about them. We do Schmodown reactions because Andrew and I are on the Schmodown, and we compete in this movie trivia show, which a lot of you guys know about. We do all kinds of fun stuff. We have a drunk watch along coming up on there. So patreon.com/teamaction is the way to get involved there. We'll talk a little bit more of that drunk watch along in a little bit. And check out the Facebook pages. That is the Action Movie Anatomy Facebook page, as well as the Action Army Facebook page, both full of fun interaction talking about movies that we like.
I just said something wrong and the chat's dying.
What'd you say?
I said baby drying because I just read what someone wrote. I thought they were talking about after the baby was born in the hotel room.
You said that, and I was like, I must have missed that.
Yeah, and I was like, I think that's what it was, but now I don't know what they're talking about. And everyone's laughing at me.
This is almost as bad as Supercell.
I'm heated. I'm very hot. All right, whatever. I hate you all. Okay, so yeah, the Patreon.com, the Drunk Watch Along is going to be super awesome. I'm really excited for it. We've got promos going. We're going to pick out, we got to figure out what booze we want to do for MI3.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what we should drink. I mean, I think our go-to classically together has always been Jameson. But then there's also Scotch. So maybe we'll get a Scotch of some kind. I know at one point, we had drank a bottle for the 100th episode, I think, Ryan Sconard.
You sent some Lafroy.
Ryan and Diana sent us a bottle of Lafroy for the 100th. That was really fun.
Yeah.
I think we'll pick something good. Finstock will be there too. We'll find out what he wants to drink. Probably
Finstock's like, I just want natural ice.
Yeah.
Natty ice, exactly.
Natty ice. So we'll figure something out. But let's talk about the people that made this film. So the film is written by Alfonso Cuarón. It's also directed by Alfonso Cuarón. There are other people involved, but I think the most important thing to talk about is that Cuarón is one of these three directors we mentioned early, the three amigos of Mexican cinema.
Yes.
Whose all careers started in the early 2000s, and basically it's Alfonso Cuarón, Alejandro González Iñárritu, and
what are you?
Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, I was like, yeah. What?
And they're all...
He's having a stroke.
They sort of all came about in as far as their prominence in America in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Around the same time, by the way, as Fernando Meirelles, who did City of God.
Yes, but which is another great movie.
But he's Brazilian.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a swath of these filmmakers coming to America making these very gritty films, kind of dark, gritty films, that there was a little bit of this, like, once one of them had succeeded, there was a little bit more of like, oh, this is exciting.
This is a real thing, yeah.
And then it sort of became, a trend or something like that. Because it's hard as a foreign filmmaker to get taken seriously in America. You have to work pretty hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And so these guys now have worked very, very hard. They're three of the most established, prolific directors in the business. They've all won the Best Director Oscar. And we are going to talk about who we actually believe is our favorite.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the three, and we're going to rank their three careers. So I wonder...
I already know who my third is, and it's crazy, but it's Guillermo.
Me too.
As much as I love Guillermo, and I've actually seen more of his movies than anyone else. I mean, obviously, Cuarón only has like a couple. And
I wonder if we have the same three.
I think we do, because Cuarón's my number one.
Me too.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's just the same. So let's talk about why.
So for me,
we didn't plan this.
Yeah. The reason that Guillermo del Toro is my least favorite of the three is not because I think in any way that he's anything other than a brilliant filmmaker. It's because I think the movies that he makes in general.
Paul Oyama agrees as well. Same thing.
I don't find myself to be as much of a fan of Guillermo's movies. It's not that they're bad movies. It's like even Shape of Water, which is a Best Picture winner.
It's beautiful and cool, but
I just don't care to ever watch it again.
It missed for me. Yeah, I don't care to watch it ever again.
I've never wanted to watch Pan's Labyrinth again, even though that I think it's probably his best film.
I've watched that a couple times. I do like it, but yeah, it doesn't call out to me to watch it. And then on the other side of that, when you go to Iñárritu, I need to watch Birdman again. I've only seen it once. I have to watch it, and I just can't get myself to do it. I love The Revenant, but you're more lukewarm on it.
I think that Iñárritu, if you were going to try to say who is the best filmmaker based on just like general acclaim and just like the amazing, like I think the answer has to just be Iñárritu. Like that's the I think obvious answer.
Yeah, I mean, he's a back-to-back best director. Like,
but I don't find that I love his movies as much. I liked Birdman a lot. I liked The Revenant a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I like his other movies, like, you know, like Babel, I like, and Amoros Perros and 21 Grams. Like, I think he makes good movies. I just don't, again, I they're incredibly dark and bleak for the most part.
Yes.
That trilogy, all three of those films, like, I saw 21 Grams in theaters, I saw Babel in theaters. I think technically he's probably the best, but I would put him second behind Cuarón only because, truthfully, Gravity and Children of Men, I just like so much.
They're so good. And I actually only finally just got around to watching Gravity last year, and I was blown away.
Gravity's so
good. It's so good. Yeah. It's so good. And so, guys, in the chat here, I'm gonna go through some of the stuff you're talking about. And the biggest thing I've noticed is the drastic contrast between the love of Del Toro. Now, most people, it looks like it's like maybe 60-40 or 70-30, where 70% don't relate to him, just like you and I do, even though we respect his films. But the whole, like, monsters and creatures thing sometimes just detaches us a little bit. Even though I love them, and I love Pan's Labyrinth, and I like Shape of Water.
Hellboy, I mean,
Hellboy's cool, but the way that Cuarón's movies actually hit me and impact me...
Blade 2, what?
Yeah, Blade 2, Guillermo. Is so different. And like, honestly, after watching the movie, like The Revenant is beautiful.
Yeah.
It truly is. But that's just the backdrop.
Yeah.
That place is just beautiful, and you have a really great lens and a good DP and a cinematographer.
And a really good second AD.
And a really good second AD who is one of the best people I've met in my whole life, Matt Haggerty. Matt Haggerty, our good friend that's been on the show, actually won a Directors Guild Award for being on the second AD on The Revenant. So give him some love. I don't know how he doesn't have social media. But the way that this movie, when I watched it yesterday, like you said, the backdrop is bleak and horrible and dirty and depressing, but he makes such a beautiful movie and he tells such a wonderful story. The way that he directs all of his actors in this movie, like Key is someone we're probably not going to talk about at all on the show.
Yeah.
And she does such a great job.
Yep.
She does such a great job of being like exactly what you think that type of person would be. Just like young, ignorant. She's just like starts sleeping with everyone to try to get pregnant. And then she's like thinks she's sick with like AIDS. She said like,
yeah.
I thought I got the bug, but then it kicked me.
Yeah.
And it was like, I loved it.
I think we're not being totally and 100% on the nose about how impressive this trio has been.
Oh yeah. No, we're literally picking between the top 1%.
Do you realize that of the last five Best Director Oscars, they've won four of them?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like we literally have to pick a 1, 2, and a 3 right now.
They're literally for 80% of the last 5 years at the Academy. They've won four of those awards. It literally went Cuarón in 2013, Iñárritu, Chazelle, and then last year was Del Toro.
And I honestly don't feel any of those were like not deserved.
No, they're all amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
same list. We got Cuarón on top, Iñárritu in the middle, and Guillermo bringing up the back end, even though we greatly respect all three of their careers and love all their films, or at least a film from each director.
I mean, Cuarón, to talk about the rest of his career, he rose to prominence in the early, the mid-90s, a film called A Little Princess, but really the one that broke him in America was Y Tu Mamá También, which is a coming-of-age story with Diego Luna and Gael García Bernal.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun. I like that movie a lot. Weirdly enough, then the Harry Potter franchise decided to go away from Christopher Columbus and give the third Harry Potter film to Cuarón, which is was a strange choice.
Yeah.
And worked kind of. I mean, Azkaban's good. That franchise really hit its stride, I think, actually two movies later when David Yates started directing the films. But
I haven't seen any of them.
But like And then Children of Men is his follow-up to a Harry Potter film. And then he doesn't make another movie until Gravity. And then he wins Best Director for that.
Yeah, he's so weird. You almost want more, right? Yeah. He's not giving me enough.
Totally.
Anthony says, I don't know if they can compare Guillermo del Toro to the others without mentioning Devil's Backbone and Kronos. I haven't seen Kronos.
And Crimson Peak.
And Devil's Backbone was good. Oh. I like that he produce The Orphanage. I love that movie.
When the kaiju hit San Francisco. When the
kaiju hit San Francisco, yeah. I directed a bad movie we with have to bad remember actors. Pacific Rim is you got to remember the goods and the bads. So that is, we're sticking to it and we're moving on. One thing that we did skip, which is kind of weird, is we're going to talk about our two actors. Clive Owen and Chiwetel Ejiofor are, I'm so glad I had to write his name down because now I can spell it.
You couldn't say it before?
I couldn't spell it. I couldn't say it until I heard you say it. Yeah. But yeah, so we got Chiwetel Ejiofor, who actually worked with Clive Owen and Spike Lee in Inside Man in 2006. The year before that, he was in Kinky Boots. And the year before that, in 2005, excuse me, the film before that was Kinky Boots in 2006. And the year before that, he was in Slow Burn in 2005.
Big shout to Joel Edgerton, who was also in Kinky Boots.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know any of those movies other than Inside Man. And then on the other side of it, you've got Derailed in 2005, Pink Panther in 2006 for Clive Owen. He's just like a quick cameo in it. And then obviously Inside Man. And this gets us to something that we've talked about a lot today off camera and what the chat has talked about a lot today. And that is Clive Owen's career. Now, Marissa loves Clive Owen.
Yeah.
I like Clive Owen, but I don't really know how I feel about him. So we're going to do our classic overly siege, underly siege, properly siege, Clive Owen. And how about you jump in?
I'm going to say that Clive Owen's overrated. Clive Owen's overrated, and I know it's weird because Clive Owen hasn't really been famous for about a decade. He has been in things. He is still a famous person. If people saw him today in a restaurant, they'd probably recognize who he is. He was in famous enough movies that he gets the credibility of still booking things. But in terms of the level of star Clive Owen was in from basically 2004 to 2009, I guess. Yeah, seven for like 3 to 5 years. People still think of Clive Owen as like this guy where, like, okay, for instance, if you were to find out tomorrow that Captain Marvel casts Clive Owen and blah, 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 like, of course.
I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Makes sense. He's like a famous actor. People like him. He's been in stuff people like. Sure. He can be in a Marvel movie. Oh, right. He's in a DC movie. Sure. Oh, he's in the next Star Wars. Sure. Like, none of those things would surprise me. So Clive Owen is still famous enough for that to be the case, and to me, that's totally overrated.
I like haven't seen any of these movies, so I'm going to go in from, like you said, 2009 Duplicity was like the last one that you liked.
Well, and the reason Duplicity was a relevant movie is because Michael Clayton in 2007, which was nominated for Best Picture, Tony Gilroy wrote and directed it. His follow-up to that film brought back Tom Wilkinson, his Best Supporting Actor nominee.
Right, right.
It put Clive Owen across from Paul Giamatti, and then it also included Julia Roberts. So it was a huge cast, very capable director, following up his biggest success, his breakout film. And it's got this kind of comic tone to it. It's a fun movie, but it's not particularly good. That's the last movie that he was in that I was like, oh, yeah, like I remember this being a big deal.
Right, because he goes, this movie, Shoot 'Em Up, then Elizabeth the Golden Age, The International, Duplicity, The Boys Are Back, which I know, Trust, and then it goes on this run of Killer Elite, Intruders, Shadow Dancer, Hemingway and Gellhorn, Blood Ties, which Hemingway and Gellhorn's a TV movie from 2012 that got released.
Yep.
Words and Pictures, Last Nights, The Confirmation, The Escape, Killer in Red.
Isn't Valerian in there somewhere?
Yeah, Valerian is the next film. Ophelia, Anon, and 3 Seconds. I have seen none of those movies. Every single movie that I just mentioned, I have not seen.
Doesn't he have a credit with Will Smith coming up soon? Isn't he in Gemini Man?
Yeah, he's in Gemini Man.
So that could be a big deal.
Yeah, so it says an over-the-hill hitman faces off against a younger clone of himself. Weird.
Sounds like a sweet premise.
Yeah, so it's Will Smith, Clive Owen, and Mary Elizabeth Parker. Right. Or Winstead, excuse me. So I like that. And this is actually going to probably be a pretty short conversation because I think he's overrated too.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I just listed off 20 movies I haven't seen, and he's just been getting paid millions and millions of dollars for these shit movies.
Now, on the other hand, overrated, underrated, like, I don't know if the rest of the world thinks of Clive Owen as affectionately as we do. We just happen to be big movie fans in this period of our lives when these movies were coming out mattered.
So
he feels more famous to me. But like, imagine you're 21 years old right now. Okay, you're finishing your junior year of college.
A lot of people like Valerian.
Yeah, like imagine you're 21 years old. Do you think you have any idea who Clive Owen is? Do you think you
right now
if you're 21?
Probably not. I mean, like Maybe. I bet you're like, oh, I know that name.
Maybe,
you're
right?
Like, okay, cool. Tell me three movies.
Like The Nick, possibly, because it was like recent and he starred and he was on billboards.
Yeah,
maybe.
Maybe.
Cinemax, I think.
Yeah, I think if you ask them to say, because you ask a 21-year-old who Clive Owen is, oh, yeah, of course. Like, okay, what are the three movies? And be like,
I'm busy on my phone.
Yeah, right. I'm busy right now. Don't talk to me, old man.
God, I hate being old. I'm so old. Yes, I'm Canadian. Can we stop talking about my citizenship? So I think the answer to the question is overrated. I mean, if you go back, though, to his prime, his, like, in America, he broke out in 02. He had been working in the UK for like 15
time.
Years. He had been like a legitimate, totally top line, like starring in series type of actor. And then on Broadway, Closer,
right?
He played the Jude Law role in on stage, which was like the starring role, I guess.
Interesting.
And then when they made the film, they put him in the other role, which I think is perfect. I can't imagine him having played Jude Law's role. He's like totally a prick and way better at that.
Yes.
And he's amazing in Closer. And he's great. And like all that whole stretch of his career is just awesome. It's just weird that it came and went so fast. And like when I saw him in Valerian in the trailer, I was like, man, he got old.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, added some age.
Happens so fast.
Happens so fast once you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Those dudes that peak, like those dudes that have their peak moment in America when they're like 42, 44, a decade later, you see it.
Yeah. You're like, holy shit. Yeah. Paul Ayama says, but I think as an actor, he's underrated. His movies don't necessarily reflect his ability. Yeah, I can agree
Fair.
With that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But you're not on the show. No, I'm just joking, brother. All right, so we're going to move on here, and we're going to talk about the writing about this, which I think is – I'm just going to pull up Wikipedia and tell you guys some really interesting stuff that I thought was the most fascinating about this. This movie is based off of a book called Children of Men by P.D. James, but Cuarón actually refused to read it. He read the abridged version while he had his writing partner, Timothy J. Sexton, read the full version. And then the two of them together came and wrote the script. Then, he didn't immediately begin the production. He went off to do Prisoner of Azkaban. And during that time, David Arada was hired to rewrite the screenplay and deliver more of this, like, United Kingdom exposed and, you know, like, just kind of get more of touch of the UK, because Cuarón is clearly not from there. I think it's a really great idea. I really like that they had this big team of writers. I like that they wrote a script and came away from it and then came back to it. I also really enjoy that Cuarón didn't read the book. He read an abridged version and had his partner read the full book so he wasn't
influenced by it.
Exactly. He was not too heavily influenced by it, but he still did justice to it. So yeah, I mean that, you know, it's other than that, there's a couple more writers. There's Mark Abraham, Tony Smith, and Eric Newman as producers. Excuse me. The other writers are Mark Fergus and Hawk Ostby. And yeah, the producers are Hillary Shore, Ian Smith, Tony Smith, Mark Abraham, and Eric Newman. We're definitely going to skip over them today just because I don't think the producers are that interesting on this movie.
Yeah.
But this is interesting. This movie didn't really do that well at the box office, but I think it did okay. It was produced by Universal, or distributed, excuse me. Cost $76 million to make. It was released on Christmas of 2006, one of my favorite Christmas films.
Oh, Christmas 2006, huh?
It grossed $35 million domestic, an additional $34 million wide for a loss of $7 million, only grossing $69 million. So
it's bizarre.
It's crazy, right? And yeah. You look back, and it's one of the best movies ever. And in its opening weekend, it was number three at $10 million. So it made a sixth of its total gross in the opening weekend. And it was still behind Night at the Museum, which was making $23 million. And
directed by?
Sean fucking Levy. And then, I hate you, Drew McQueenie. and then the other one was The Pursuit of Happiness at $12 million, I think in like week three or something like that, which makes sense. Will Smith was on top of the world at that time.
This is like the end of the Will Smith run.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. This is like when it started to slow down.
So critically, this movie's got a 7.9 on IMDb, and that is where I'm upset, because it's not, you got to be an 8.1 above to be in the top 250, but then you go to Rotten Tomatoes, all critics give it a 92, top give it a 90, and the audience give it an 85, which is much more appropriate.
Yeah.
Even if it was just 85, I'd be okay with that.
Totally. That's an 8.5.
Yeah.
I would put it like in the top 50 probably.
Right. But even if it was an 8.2 on IMDb, it just seems crazy to me. So yeah, those are the critical and box office about them, and we're gonna hop into our questions here. And I love this. Russell Howe asked this like a week ago, and I think it's really interesting.
Don't you think it's funny looking back on? So before we get into this, Russell Howe, I promise you, I'm not jumping over your answer here. But I think it's funny looking back to even just 2006. It's 12 years ago. At that point, independent filmmaking and the independent film market was in such a different place. I mean, when we went to see the private screening of my friend Richie Gray's last film, Broken Ghost,
right,
a couple weeks ago, he talked about the kind of budgets that he was getting offered by companies to make these films, right? He said a few years ago, somebody would have said, you know, $3 million, $4 million. He's like, today, right, they're asking you, can you make it for $600,000? And the reason is because the market for independent films, the distribution model is so broken now that if you try to put a film, say, on Netflix, unless it's in that top 12 or 15 new releases that it's being featured by a lot of money, it just gets lost. No one's going to find it. Nobody
can't advertise.
There's no video store to go through the rows and maybe, you know, get caught by the cover of a film. Like, independent filmmaking is in such a different place now that even in 2006, that this movie would open on Christmas is that so different than what anybody would do today. Like, yeah, nobody would open a movie like this on Christmas anymore.
No way. This is like spring.
Yeah.
Or fall.
Yeah.
You don't do it around the blockbusters at all.
Not
and
even
you don't
close.
Do it around family time. You do it when we're all waiting for good movies to come out or after they've all just came out.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you don't put this up against, like, a movie that gets released on Christmas is like, it's going to be like Lincoln, or it's going to be like a giant Marvel movie,
right,
or Star Wars,
right,
or it's going to be some kids
movie,
something
animated.
Think about
all the biggest Lord of the Rings trilogy,
yeah,
and the Star Wars new trilogy. It's like they're all Christmas movies.
Yeah.
Because families are all together, it's time to make the most money. So I get maybe that's what they were trying to do, is make more money, but it's like, what family is going to go watch Children of Men?
Yeah, this is just a different world. I mean, and again, it started to change very quickly. Marvel was introduced 2 years later. Like, the entire new age of movies that we live in now started to evolve, the whole tentpole theory, in the next 5 years. Like,
right,
we live in a different world now. This would never happen today. So anyway, just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great point.
So we are going to get an AMA question. These are questions that are submitted. Actually, do you want to do favorite line first? We almost skipped it.
Oh my gosh, yeah. We've been jumping all around. See, guys, you take 1 week off, you move one day over, and you don't know where the hell you are. Yeah, so favorite line, guys, is your favorite line from the film. Pretty straightforward. Pull my finger.
Yeah. I love when it's actually in the trailer, when Key shows Theo the baby in the barn. And I love that when Chiwetel Ejiofor walks in, I just love it that he puts his hand on his shoulder, and as he turns around, he says, "Now you know what's at stake."
Yes.
That's my favorite line in the movie, because it sets the tone. He's not saying it to Clive Owen. He's saying it to us. He's saying it to the audience.
Yeah.
Now
we know what this movie's really about.
Exactly. It means as much to Clive Owen as it does to us as an audience. As an audience, it's like, this is cool, this is dark, this is gritty, this has been interesting. Wow, Julianne Moore. Wow, what is this movie? And then it's like,
it's so simple.
Now you know it's at stake. And then you're like, got it. That's what this movie's about. Now I get it. Now we have an hour to get her from here to safe.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm gonna kind of cheat with my favorite line, because it's not about lines for me in this movie. Like, there's a couple. I love the swan song in the ear. It's the last time you're ever going to hear that frequency. It's just like a great jab that Julianne Moore throws to him. But I wrote down, yeah, now you know what's at stake. It's the first baby in 18 years. You can't call it Froley. Laughed at that. But for me, there's two scenes.
Yeah.
There's the one where Key's talking about when she got pregnant. That's just such a beautiful monologue. She delivers it so perfectly, and it really frames what it would be like to be a young adult woman, female, in that time. Your only job is to try to save humanity, essentially.
Yeah.
That's all you care about.
Yep.
So I loved that. The other one is that incredible shot around the corner where you're on Clive, and you got in the background to blurt out Michael Caine telling the story about why him and Julianne Moore didn't work out.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm almost getting teared up right now just talking about it. Like, it's just, again, talk about the dirtiest, saddest subject matter and the most beautiful shot.
Yeah.
You can't take your eyes away from it, because it's just such, Clive does such a wonderful job of hearing and feeling and going through the emotions that every word Michael Caine says. And Michael Caine, this is Alfred level co-star, like, greatest in his career.
Yeah.
This movie is so phenomenal. And, yeah, and then I also love at the very, very end, he's like, "Yeah, I've talked my way out of worse situations than this."
Yeah.
And you're like, you're going to die.
Right.
You're dead now. You're giving up. You're sacrificing yourself.
Yep.
So anyway, those are all my favorite lines. They are absolutely incredible. But guys, just go back and watch that scene again with Clive around the corner. It's phenomenal.
The movie has like 6 to 10 shots that are all amazing. All just like, you know, just like beautiful, like really, really effective.
Yeah.
Effective, I think, is that's probably the best word to use. All the choices that Cuarón makes, we haven't even really talked about, hardly at all, the shot in the car. We've, like, really barely talked about it.
Oh, I know. Really quickly, a couple lines. Very odd what happens in a world without children's voices. Yeah, that's a great line.
There's all these hallmarks of post-apocalyptic films, and one of the things that you get in so many of these movies is at some point somebody gives a monologue about the day they realize it was happening.
Yeah.
Or they tell a story.
Oh yeah, the nurse. She does a great job when she go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, she tells that story, and it's a good reminder of a lot of these films. Like, I believe 28 Days Later has the one where the guy's talking about his family going to the train trying to buy a spot, and then his sister, and right, they all get crushed under their feet.
Yeah.
That's that moment. This story about, you know, the infertility. You know,
she calls her friend. She hasn't had one in 4 weeks either.
Yeah, that moment. You know, there's, you know, Linda Hamilton in the beginning of Terminator 2, the voiceover that starts the film,
yes.
The date, you know, all these things, Skynet became active. It's like there's this, like, incredibly systematic way that there's always like that one moment that kind of sets the tone for the movie,
right? Because it's like you would think when you actually as an audience member contextualize what they're saying, you're like, whoa,
you're like, I can imagine
not
having gone through that.
Kid being born in a hospital, there's no appointments in the next month. That would be the scariest shit ever.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Couple more lines here. I forgot how small they were. That's a great line.
Yeah.
And then the other one that I love is Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You realize he snaps. He can't believe it. So, yeah, those are our favorite lines, guys. Now we will finally get to Russell Howell's question.
So Russell Howell asked, remember right before Daniel Craig was announced as Bond, there was rumors that Clive Owen was going to be in the running as Bond. Would you have liked to see Clive Owen James Bond-led movie? If so, what do you think Owen would bring to the table as 007? Well, I do remember that. It was just before Casino Royale, and Daniel Craig had just done Layer Cake, and there was a question of whether or not he was going to be Bond.
Right.
When he was announced, he was kind of an unknown. Clive Owen at that moment was surging. He would have been a much more A-list choice at that point, especially in America.
Yeah.
And I think that Daniel Craig has been as good as Bond as we could have ever hoped for, and I think that Clive Owen works a lot better for me when he's not trying to be
a badass.
Yeah, or suave. I think he's better when he's a little rougher around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why he's so good in Closer to me. That's why he's so good in this movie.
Yeah.
Bond is dark, but Bond has to be so fucking charming. He has to be like, you have to just like melt.
Yeah, and I don't really, so for me, and also like I hated Shoot 'Em Up. Like, I know it hadn't come out yet by the time.
Sucked.
It's so bad, and like, yeah, I like Clive, but I truly believe that Daniel Craig is the best Bond we've ever had, even over Connery, which I know is the blasphemous thing to say. But I think that the only reason that Daniel Craig's career as Bond hasn't been as gleaming and as brilliant and as pristine is because of the films that he actually had to act in. Imagine if he had better writing and you got Goldfinger with Daniel Craig instead of fucking Spectre. You know, like, Spectre was one of the worst things I've ever seen, and it wasn't because of him.
Yeah, if he had had, I mean, because Skyfall is above average to most people. Some people think it's a classic, but if one of the other two had been, like, very good, if one of the other two hadn't just been garbage, then, you know, we'd be looking at a different story. And now, who even knows what's going to happen with Bond 25 with Danny Boyle exiting? It's like a whole different.
Yeah.
Yeah, a whole different thing.
It's Craig's last one, correct?
Yep. Supposedly he signed on.
And then Danny quits after months because of creative differences, which I'm just like, you're having creative differences with Danny Boyle in a Bond movie? Like, what's
right.
happening?
Yeah, just let him do what he wants to do.
Yeah, let him do what he wants to do. He's brilliant.
An Oscar winner. Your movies suck.
Yeah, exactly. and then, Paul Oyama, that guy. Other AMA question. Where does that one take of the baby being taken out of the building sit amongst the best one takes and shots, just shots, cinematography-wise, in history? I put up there with A Touch of Evil opening, the Goodfellas Copacabana shot. That's a great one. The opening of The Player, the party shot in Hitchcock's Notorious. I love the opening of Boogie Nights, the tracking shot through that. I also love the tracking shot of William H. Macy going in to his car, getting his gun, coming back, seeing his wife, and killing himself. Those are some of my favorites.
Yeah.
I kind of put you on the spot here.
No, I know. I mean, that's great. I mean, Touch of Evil is the classic. That's the most famous, the Orson Welles one. You know, the Goodfellas one is like one of the most iconic shots in that film. And that's such a great shot, too, because it moves so much. And it really, they tell a whole story. They set such a tone in that. I love The Player. Like, it's cool, Paul, that you mentioned that. I just rewatched that movie about 2 weeks ago. I hadn't seen it in a long time. Mm-hmm. But when I was 11 years old, my older brother got me 2 VHS tapes for my birthday 1 year from like a used record store or something. One of them was Point Break. The other one was The Player. Point Break became my favorite movie of all time. And The Player became a movie that, like, a lot of people haven't watched, and it's just, like, absolutely excellent. And that opening shot is amazing, where it goes all around the studio lot.
What about the Snake Eyes tracking shot?
I love that. Is true. It's a great tracking shot.
It is a really good one.
So unnecessary. Who suggested that?
No, I'm looking up online some of the best ones.
That's terrific. Yeah, I think the tracking shot in this movie, though, is pretty amazing. And also, I mean, that tracking shot is incredible. I would argue the one in the car is almost as incredible.
Oh, it's
not a tracking shot, but the fact that it's a single take, we talked about this. But yeah, the apparatus they built, you can look this up online. It's like they basically designed a boat that you put on top of a car that's on top of a moving platform. And
because actors aren't allowed to drive.
The apparatus has a camera that you're able to like basically move around inside the car. You're controlling it from above the car and move around to anybody in the car, which is how you get the driving forward, driving backwards, never cutting, moving around inside the car. Like, it's like the most personal, impressive, crazy, amazing shot I've ever seen. Like, it's, and then the fact when the violence starts, it just keeps going.
Yeah, Julianne Moore getting capped and the blood and the freak out and the bike flip and the flames and all the extras running out of the wood. It's incredible.
It's amazing.
I do believe it's more impressive than the one at the end. So some of the other ones that I really love and that I'm also looking up because it's hard to think of this on the spot. There's the Shining one with Danny behind on the thing when he sees the girls. That's a great one. I love the Kill Bill over shot that tracks her from the bathroom all the way out to the dance floor. Really amazing. And the Pulp Fiction one where Willis goes back into the house, right?
I didn't even remember.
I didn't even realize it was a tracking shot.
Yeah, neither
but
did I.
That's pretty cool. So Paul and Russell, thank you guys so much for your questions. Those are our favorite tracking shots, and I think we both agree that Daniel Craig, it ended where it needed to end.
Yeah, I don't think Clive Owen would have brought the right energy to the role. So moving on, guys, we just have a couple things
old
left.
Old boy. I was going to say the old boy hallways, the original old boy hallways fight scene with the hammer and like 100 guards. It's like a long shot. I had to say it real quick.
Like,
sorry. Yeah, it is.
There's only one category left here to talk about on the show, guys, and that is there are 3 action movie categories. Totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, and ridiculously legitimate. This is another one of those situations where I don't think there's a question. This movie's totally legit. There's nothing about this that feels silly. There's nothing about it that feels over the top. It's just amazing.
It is, and I love that all you have to do is say that women are infertile, and that's such a sound point.
Yeah, you know?
You don't need to do anything other than that, and it's like, even just hearing that as a 30-year-old man, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
That would be it.
Yep.
That'd be the end.
Yep.
Yep.
So, just last thing to talk about here on the show, guys, that's called
The Pitch.
Exactly.
Still got it.
So, yeah, nice. A couple things coming up, guys. I believe, unless this is incorrect.
It says 1 and 2 on the list.
Yeah, so I think this is what we want to do here, guys. So some of you may remember that early, very early on, this was like the 6th episode we ever did, we did Predator. We covered the first Predator.
Yes, we did.
Which
our good friend Jason was on the show.
Yes. And Predator is one of my favorite films ever made. I love the first Predator. Predator 2, not as good.
Nope.
But still entertaining.
It has some actors in it that we appreciate.
Scott Bill Paxton's got Gary Busey. It's got Danny Glover.
Yes.
I like Predator 2 enough. We're going to watch Predator 2 this week, and we're going to decide how much we want to lean into Predator 1, and how much. And then the following week, provided it's good, we will be doing Shane Black's new film, The Predator.
Yes. Which I'm like curious now that they've put so much weight on this like alien / predator evolved creature.
Yeah. Now I don't know if we want to get really crazy here, and how much time we would have to do it. Do you want to watch Predator 1, Predator 2, and Predators? Screw the alien movies, because those don't count.
Right.
In my mind, they don't count.
Right.
But do you want to watch all 3 and do a, like, trifecta Predator episode? Like, all of the standalone Predator movies?
It sounds like a great idea.
It's just two
more movies we have to watch in a week. But I'm not going to say no, because I like the idea of it a lot.
I think if we... Yeah, we can
do it.
Predator 1, we don't necessarily have to rewatch. I've seen it so many times. But I think that's the plan, guys, is we're going to be doing a Predator special next week. And provided the new one is good, the following week we'll be doing that as well. Last thing but not least, guys, on the 15th of September, 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, we are going to be doing a drunk watch-along with Bobby Finstock, Bobby Gucci, my manager in the Movie Trivia Schmodown. It is going to be Mission Impossible 3. That's the film we've decided upon. We'll be watching it streaming. You guys will be watching our reactions as we watch the film. We're very excited. We'll be doing the drinking games, all kinds of fun things. If you want to watch that, go to patreon.com/teamactionafterdark. Just a one-time pledge. We're trying this out. We're trying to run the whole thing ourselves because, obviously, this is a professional workspace, and getting wasted here is not something that we really want to do.
The other way you can find that is patreon.com/teamaction. You can, if you're a donator of $10 or more, you will get a code sent to you for free. It'll be the link. If you are below $10, then you can either up it or you can just wait till we put it up, probably in a couple weeks or maybe even a month. We'll make it available to the public so you can watch us be buffoons. But guys, we are so excited to encourage day drinking for work.
It's gonna be fantastic. We'll be doing it in a totally safe, uber-centric environment, guys. Yes. So don't you worry. All right, guys, that's gonna wrap us up. Thank you so much for watching. Thank you so much for listening. Andrew, where can the folks find you?
Guys, you can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter, and you guys can also find me now esports casting for Clash Royale. It's a really exciting gig that I just got. My first episodes went up yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm doing it for EU and the NA. I'm a huge fan of the game. I'm super nerd about it. And I am actually honored to be a part of their team. There was thousands of people that tried out. So yeah, check it out. I would love for you guys to join me on one of those streams.
Sweet. All right, guys, thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. Here's the rest of your